Welcome to Astounding Stories of Space and Time. I'm Martell, reading The Skylark of Space by E.E. Smith. Chapter 15. They descended rapidly over a large city set in the middle of a vast, level, beautifully planted plain. As they watched, the city vanished and became a mountain summit with valleys falling away on all sides, as far as the eye could reach.
"Huh. I never saw a mirage like that before," Seton exclaimed. "But we'll land if we finally have to swim."
The ship landed gently upon the summit, its occupants more than half expecting the mountain to disappear beneath them. Nothing happened, however, and the five clustered in the lock, wondering whether or not to disembark. They could see no sign of life, but each felt the presence of a vast, invisible something. Suddenly a man materialized in the air before them, a man identical with Seton in every detail, down to the smudge of grease under one eye and the exact design of his Hawaiian sports shirt.
"Hello, folks," he said in Seton's tone and style. "Surprised that I know your language? Huh? Yeah, you would be. Don't even understand telepathy or the ether or the relationship between time and space, not even the fourth dimension."
Changing instantaneously from Seton's form to Dorothy's, the stranger went on without a break.
"Electrons and neutrons and things. Nothing here either."
The form became Duquesne's.
"For your type, but blind, dull, stupid, another nothing, as Martin Crane the same, as Peggy still the same, as was, of course, to be expected. Since you are all nothings, in essence, of a race so low in the scale that it will be millions of years before it will arise even above death and death's clumsy attendant necessity, sex, it is, of course, necessary for me to make of you nothings. In fact, to dematerialize you."
In Seton's form, the being stared at Seton, who felt his senses reel under the impact of an awful, if insubstantial, blow. Seton fought back with all his mind and remained standing.
"What's this?" the stranger exclaimed in surprise. "This is the first time in millions of cycles that mere matter, which is only a manifestation of mind, has refused to obey a mind of power. There's some screwy somewhere."
He switched to Crane's shape.
Not a perfect reproduction. There is some subtle difference. The external form is the same, the internal structure likewise. The molecules of substance are arranged properly, as are the atoms in the molecules. The electrons, neutrons, protons, positrons, neutrinos, mesons. Nothing amiss on that level, on the third level."
"Let's go," Seton exclaimed, drawing Dorothy backward and reaching for the airlock switch. "This dematerialization stuff may be pie for him, but believe me, it's none of my dish."
"No, no," the stranger remonstrated. "You really must stay and be dematerialized, alive or dead."
He drew his pistol. Being in Crane's form, he drew slowly, as Crane did, and Seton's Mark I shell struck him before the pistol cleared his pocket. The pseudo-body was volatilized, but just to make sure, Crane fired a Mark V into the ground through the last open chink of the closing lock.
Seton leaped to the board. As he did so, a creature materialized in the air in front of him and crashed to the floor as he threw on the power. It was a frightful thing. Outrageous teeth, long claws, and an automatic pistol held in a human hand. Forced flat by the fierce acceleration, it was unable to lift either itself or the weapon.
"We take one trick," Seton blazed. "Stick to matter, and I'll run along with you till my ankles catch fire."
"That is a childish defiance. It speaks well for your courage, but not for your intelligence," the animal said and vanished.
A moment later, Seton's hair stood on end as a pistol appeared upon his board, clamped to it by bands of steel. The slide jerked,
The trigger moved. The hammer came down. However, there was no explosion, but merely a click. Seaton, paralyzed by the rapid succession of stunning events, was surprised to find himself still alive.
Oh, I was almost sure it wouldn't explode. Oh, I was almost sure it wouldn't explode.
The gun barrel said chattily in a harsh metallic voice,
"You say I haven't derived the formula of your subnuclear structure yet, hence I could not make an actual explosive. By the use of crude force, I could kill you in any one of many different ways."
"Name one," Seaton snapped. "Two, if you like. I could materialize us five masses of metal directly over your heads and fall. I could, by a sufficient concentration of effort, materialize a sun in your immediate path. Either method would succeed, would it not?"
I guess it would, Seaton admitted grudgingly.
But such crude work is distasteful in the extreme and is never under any conditions mandatory. Furthermore, you are not quite the complete nothings that my first rough analysis seemed to indicate. In particular, the Duquesne of you has the rudiments of a quality which, while it cannot be called mental ability, may in time develop into a quality which may just possibly make him assimilable into the purely intellectual stratum. Furthermore, you have given me a notable and entirely unexpected amount of exercise and enjoyment, and can be made to give me more, much more, as follows. I will spend the next 60 of your minutes at work upon that formula. Your subnuclear structure, its derivation, is comparatively simple, requiring only the solution of 97 simultaneous differential equations and an integration in 97 dimensions. If you can interfere with my computation sufficiently to prevent me from deriving that formula within the stipulated period of time, you may return to your fellow nothings exactly as you are now. The first minute begins when the sweep hand of your chronometer touches zero. That is, now. Seaton cut the power to one gravity and sat up, eyes closed tight and frowning in the intensity of his mental effort.
"You can't do it, you immaterial lug," he thought savagely. "There are too many variables. No mind, however inhuman, can handle more than 91 differentials at once. You're wrong. That's theta, not epsilon. It's X, not Y or Z. Alpha, beta. Ha, there's a slip, a bad one. Gotta go back, start all over. Nobody can integrate above 96 brackets. Nobody and no thing or mind in this whole entire cockeyed universe."
Seaton cast aside any thought of the horror of their position. He denied any feeling of suspense. He refused to consider the fact that both he and his beloved Dorothy might at any instant be hurled into nothingness. Closing his mind deliberately to everything else, he fought that weirdly inimical entity with everything he had, with all his single-mindedness of purpose, with all his power of concentration, with all the massed and directed strength of his keen, highly trained brain. The hour passed.
"You win," the gun barrel said. "More particularly, I should say that the Duquesne of you won. To my surprise and delight, that one developed his nascent quality very markedly during this short hour. Keep on going as you have been going, my potential kinsman. Keep on studying under those Eastern masters as you have been studying, and it is within the realm of possibility that even in your short lifetime you may become capable of withstanding the stresses concomitant with the introduction into our ranks."
The pistol vanished. So did the planet behind them. The enveloping, pervading field of mental force disappeared. All five knew, surely without any trace of doubt, that that entity, whatever it had been, had gone.
"Did all that really happen, Dick?" Dorothy asked tremulously. "Or have I been having the great-great-grandfather of all nightmares?"
I guess it happened, or maybe... Mart, if you could code that and shove it into a mechanical brain, what answer do you think would come out?"
"I don't know. I simply do not know." Crane's mind, the mind of a highly trained engineer, rebelled. No part of this whole fantastic episode could be explained by anything he knew. None of it could possibly have happened nevertheless. Either it happened, or we were hypnotized. If so, who was the hypnotist and where? Above all, why? It must have happened, Dick. I'll buy that, wild as it sounds. Now, DeQuesney, how about you? It happened. I don't know how or why it did, but I believe that it did. I've quit denying the impossibility of anything. If I had believed that your steam bath flew out of the window by itself that day, none of us would be here now. If it happened, you were apparently the prime operator in saving our bacon. Who in blazes are those Eastern masters you've been studying under? What did you study?
I don't know.
He lit a cigarette, took two deep inhalations. I wish I did. I've studied several esoteric philosophies. Perhaps I can find out which one it was. I'll certainly try, for that gentleman would be my idea of heaven. He left the room. It took some time for the four to recover from the shock of that encounter. In fact, they had not yet fully recovered from it, when Crane found a close cluster of stars, each emitting a peculiar greenish light, which in the spectroscope blazed with copper lines. When they had approached so close that the suns were widely spaced in the heavens, Crane asked Seton to take his place at the board while he and Margaret tried to locate a planet. They went down to the observatory, but found they were still too far away, and began taking notes. Crane's mind was not upon his work, however, but was filled with thoughts of the girl at his side. The intervals between comments became longer and longer until the two were standing in silence. The Skylark lurched a little, as she had done hundreds of times before. As usual, Crane put out a steadying arm. This time, however, in that highly charged atmosphere, the gesture took on a new significance. Both blushed hotly, and as their eyes met, each saw what they had both wanted most to see. Slowly, almost as though without volition, Crane put his other arm around her. A wave of deeper crimson flooded her face, but her lips lifted to his, and her arms went up around his neck. "Margaret, Peggy, I had intended to wait, but why should we wait? You know how much I love you, my dearest."
"I think I do. I know I do. My Martin."
Presently they made their way back to the engine room, hoping that their singing joy was inaudible, their new status invisible. They might have kept their secret for a time, had not Seton promptly asked, "What did you find, Mart?" The always self-possessed Crane looked panicky. Margaret's fair face glowed a deeper and deeper pink.
"Yes. What did you find?" Dorothy demanded with a sudden vivid smile of understanding.
"My future wife,"
Crane answered steadily. The two girls hugged each other. The two men gripped hands, each of the four knowing that in these two unions there was nothing whatever of passing fancy. A planet was located, and the Skylark flew toward it.
"It's pretty deep in, Mart. DeQuesney and I haven't got enough dope yet to pilot this mess of suns, so we don't know exactly where any of them really are. But that planet's somewhere down in the middle. Would that make any difference?"
"No, there are many closer ones, but they're too big or too small, or lack water or atmosphere, or have some other drawback. Go ahead."
When they neared atmosphere and cut the drive, there were 17 great suns scattered in all directions in the sky. "Air pressure at the surface, 30 pounds per square inch. Composition, approximately normal, except for 0.3% of a fragment non-poisonous gas with which I am not familiar. Temperature 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Surface gravity, 4/10 Earth," came the various reports. Seton let the vessel settle slowly toward the ocean beneath them. The water was an intensely deep blue. He took a sample, ran it through the machine, and yelled, "Ammoniacal copper sulfate! Hot dog! Let's go!" Seaton laid a course toward the nearest continent.
Please join me next time for another exciting chapter of The Skylark of Space by E.E. Smith, here on Astounding Stories of Space and Time. Till then, watch the skies.